Why don't we jump right into it? First of all, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself to Destiny? I'm not sure how much he is aware of you or his community.
I'm a pollster. My name's Laksha. I run the surveys for The Argument magazine. I also co-founded Split Ticket, which is the election modeling site. So that's me.
I'm
Cool.
glad to
Destiny,
meet
nice
you.
to meet
Thank
you.
you for connecting us. Yeah, I stream and screw with people on the internet and do politics and stuff sometimes. Yeah.
Okay, since we are limited on time, what I want to do is ask you guys like kind of rapid fire questions, and then we'll land on the fifth question here, and we'll kind of let you guys sort of go back and forth. This I'm not framing this as a debate. If you guys want to debate, that's fine. I just was curious to see this interaction. And then we'll do it again the second time. We'll do another rapid fire sequence and then land on the last questions, and then you guys can have whatever conversation you want. I'm not here to give my input. I'm here to just keep the conversation flowing. If I do, issue like a red flag, and I'll stop. But yeah. So the first question I want to pose to both of you guys, and Laksha, why don't you go first? And just briefly, if you can, what is the current state of the Republican Party electorally?
Bad. Like, just bad. I mean, they're almost certain to lose the House. The Senate, which has an R plus five bias, is like they have a 40% chance of losing that thing, which you should never be in the position to lose. And truth be told, the electoral situation's only getting worse for them thanks to the war in Iran. So bad, but not catastrophic because they're still slight favorites to hold the Senate.
Okay, Destiny.
Yeah, I would probably agree with all that, I think.
All right, what's the current state of the Democratic Party electorally?
Electorally, it's all right, I would say. It's not great, it's not terrible. It's all right. It's what you'd expect from an opposition party with a high turnout coalition against a very unpopular president, but it's nothing special.
I would say, I guess. I would just exaggerate that and say kind of abysmal, and that it's cool that we're hopefully going to win. But I said this for Kamala v. Trump, like winning all seven swing states in my mind is still a failure. I feel like it should be an completely unprecedented blowout given how absolutely terrible the opposition party is right now. But I mean, yeah. But I mean, like we're going to win
Well,
the House at least, so it's okay, I guess. Yeah.
I think that answer dovetails quite nicely with this question, which is what. Maybe we can pause on this question, actually. This one would be a good one to kind of get more into the substance. But the question is, what messaging strategy broadly is most likely to yield optimal election results for Democrats? And what strategies are working best so far? If you want to go ahead and start, Laksha.
Okay, I'd say three key things: anti-war, anti-culture war, and anti-corporate.
Can you get into more detail and flesh that out just a little bit more for me? Like what
Sure.
candidates are seeing the most success right now, and what do you attribute that to?
Sure. So I think anti-war to start with, anti-war has always been like the key plank of the success behind the Democratic Party in, the 2000s. That's what brought them back from, the wilderness. That's what got Barack Obama to the presidency. War really was the first left-wing rupture in the Biden coalition in 2023, the war in Israel and Gaza. Regardless of what you think about that war, it is undeniable that it basically split apart the Democratic coalition. Anti-war has always been something that gets the working class pretty supportive of you because basically the interventionist side is mostly a lot of elites and heavily college-educated NatSec type of people, which generally vote diametrically opposite to what most people actually want. And it's viewed in times of economic strife as a resource drain. The second point then to bring to that is economic strife, right? At this time, real wages are not nearly growing as much as they were in the mid-2010s. You have inflation, which is persistently and stubbornly making it harder for people to afford things. The costs of buying a house are higher. Survey data shows people, especially young people, feel like there's no financial future. It ties directly into anti-war, and a key pillar of this that blends with it is also anti-AI. People really are worrying about their financial future because they think that AI and data centers and really corporations in general are making it harder for them to afford a good life, to be employed. That's why I would say those are the two main things. And then anti-culture war, really the thing that goes against the Democratic Party is that they keep getting suckered into culture war after culture war, right? Like, people don't really agree with the Democrats on cultural issues that they've adopted over the last 8 years, but the economic planks that they have, the populist economic planks, which personally, I actually don't agree with a lot of those economic planks, but if we're talking about what's electorally effective, that is electorally effective. Focusing on that gets you the working class back. Focusing on the culture war drives them away. So I would say those are the key points.
Okay, I'm a little bit curious to ask you more, but I want to let Destiny jump in here.
Okay, this guy is the fucking, this guy is the poll guy, okay? I'm going to agree with everything he says. I'm not going to fight him on any topics right now. So, broadly speaking, everything he says seems like it checks out to me. But, yeah, I'm not going to disagree with this guy. Are you crazy?
Well, I guess, I mean, just to get into it a little bit deeper, you recently came out, Laksha, with an article kind of exploring the trans issue for Democrats. If you're advising a campaign, like, how would you advise them to respond to questions like, you know, should trans girls play in sports?
You say no if you're in a swing state, and if you're in Manhattan, you say whatever the hell you want. It's just like, this is something where, like, outside of, like, Manhattan, San Francisco, like, you know, the bluest of blue areas, people just straight up do not agree. It does not make sense to make this a flashpoint. I understand that people say if you give an inch, you cede a mile. But the truth is, at this point, you've already ceded the mile. Now you're trying to get back a little bit of that ground. And by insisting on something that even your own base doesn't agree with, you are basically just endangering everything else associated with that issue. So I would say there are times at which you literally have to triangulate and say, no, I'm not for that. That's what Rob Sand did in Iowa. And that's also why he's... in part, really avoided being suckered into the culture wars, and he's polling very, very well there.
What about a presidential candidate?
I'd say the same thing for a presidential candidate. You have to win the swing states.
Okay. All right, so then the next question that I have for you guys is, are there even strong or mild indicators? And I think, Laksha, you're going to be coming at it more from a polling electoral results standpoint. I think, Destiny, you're more tapped into kind of the online discourse. But the question is, are there strong or even mild indicators of a left-wing Tea Party moment for Democrats? Or does it appear as though the party will remain center-left or even move closer towards the center?
I want to hear Destiny say this first, because I have a bunch of poll data, but I think I really want to hear his perspective.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'd rather talk first, because I'm just going to copy this guy, or I'm going to be a contrarian, I'll be a whatever. So, okay, so the feeling that I have, okay, I'm curious what his poll data will say. The feeling that I have is that while there's a lot of online rhetoric about when you say a Tea Party, you're implying that kind of like the more socialist wing is going to form some kind of electorally plausible thing inside of the Democratic Party?
Or begin the process of maybe starting something like that.
The feeling I have, and a lot of this ties maybe less to hard numbers, but just like the general feeling I get when I look at the way they conduct themselves online and the types of things they talk about, is that it's not a coalition of people that are as interested in political power. They're not trying to necessarily win elections. They don't make like electoral choices. They make choices for kind of like rhetoric and marketing on online platforms. So as a result of that, I just don't ever see them having... I don't ever see them operating in a way that is strategic enough to form that type of thing. Like, I feel like when the Tea Party started, like, I feel like the Tea Party moment for the Democrats would have been the Justice Dems that they had their four people who got elected. Yeah, you can send them up. You're good. They had their people that got elected, but then I feel like they never built on that. Like, the Justice Dem movement kind of died in the next few elections. Like, I think at some point people thought there were going to be 20, 30, 40, 50 new Justice Dems that were elected as a result of this movement across the country. But instead you get four new Dems in very blue areas, and then that was kind of it. Whereas it feels like for the Tea Party, I believe, did the Freedom Caucus come from the Tea Party?
I believe so.
And then you had, like, your Michelle Bachmann. You had... like arguably like Sarah Palin, I think it was like a Tea Party. Like it felt like they were geared towards kind of acquiring or assuming political power very early on. So yeah. So I guess the short answer is no, I don't see there being a Tea Party moment, at least not from the socialist types, because they just don't seem to be playing the game of politics. It seems like they're doing a different game. And without having that strategic electoral focus, I just don't see them being able to build a movement. Yeah. Like that. This is my feeling.
Oh, I see an anti-establishment movement in the Democratic Party. I do not see an insurgent socialist wing that is about to take over. We are conflating an incredibly unserious group with absolutely no theory of how to assemble and hold political power with serious and talented young politicians that understand how to triangulate, how to make compromises, how to tell their base to pound sand when they need to, and with voters who are broadly sick of the same old from the Democratic Party, which they associate with losing to Trump twice now. That is meaningfully different from a left-wing socialist Tea Party. What I see is that Democratic base voters absolutely hate their party. They are really, really, really mad at the Democrats. Keep in mind, this does not swing over to independents liking Republicans more than Democrats. Independents still favor Democrats. This is basically just Democrats hate themselves. Which, honestly, like, if you spend any time talking to, like, any Democrat, you'll come out of it pretty quickly that, like, they're pretty happy with their own lives. They just hate the Democratic Party. and what happens here, Hutch, is that, like, if you're looking at an insurgent movement, there's two ways to look at it. Is there something that is remaking the policy plank of the Democratic Party? No. There's nothing that I can point to that says, like, the Democratic Party has wholesale remade itself. There is something I can point to that says the Democratic Party is throwing out old politicians or politicians associated with the old guard or politicians that have a lot of establishment backing in favor of insurgents. So Zohran Mamdani, one of the best examples, right? Like, 2016, he'd never have beaten Andrew Cuomo. Even with all of this scandal, he wouldn't have leapfrogged the other, like, you know, Brad Lander, Adrian Adams, all these people. Like, it wasn't just Cuomo that he beat. He lapped everyone. That is part of it. Graham Plattner and Janet Mills. I mean, I've said I think Plattner's a moron, but, like, he's leading, and he's leading because Janet Mills is a weak candidate with the Democratic Party's voters right now. So. Yeah. That's a big thing. And that is like an actual insurgency from voters, but it is not a socialist wing insurgency.
What would you say? Because there's a lot of claims that are made by, I would say, like the leftist media space that.
Oh, wait. Can I say one quick thing on that real quick just to add to
that? Yeah, go ahead.
One thing that I really appreciate that the answer for, how do you pronounce your name again?
Laksha?
Wait, say that.
Laksha.
One thing that Laksha said earlier was that there are different campaign strategies that operate depending on where you're at, which I think people lose track of a lot online. We all just view basically the entire election as just one massive pull between the entire population. The people that have won power, I think on that more kind of like populist or anti-establishment or anti-institutional front like Zohran Mamdani also publicly acknowledge that, which I really appreciate. Like, I think Zohran has done a really, really good job at saying like there's a place in the Democratic Party for different politicians to win in different areas. And that's rhetoric that you never hear from that insurgent left ever. Holy shit. Yeah.
What would you say, Laksha? Because there are a lot of people in leftist media spaces that are insisting that the ground is very fertile right now for an insurgent takeover from the leftists. Like, how are these candidates actually doing? I know Mamdani is a very notable case, and there was also a semi-recent election, special election in Texas, where there was a progressive candidate, I think, overperformed by like 32 points. How are those types of candidates doing so far in the off-cycle election and special elections? How are they poised to do going into the primaries and the midterms?
Everyone loves a winner, okay? So, like, you could say, like, that I could sit here and I could make the argument that candidate overperforming by 32 in Texas was really just a Democratic candidate rather than, like, a socialist insurgent that owes their victory to, like, that, right? Socialists are going to say that Afton Ben, who is, like, defund the police type of person, right? She's extremely liberal, extremely left-wing. They could say, oh, it's because of her platform that she overperformed. I would personally say she overperformed just like every other Democratic candidate with a pulse did, because Democrats have a big turnout differential advantage right now. They're just fired up to vote, and they will vote for a dog catcher, they'll vote for a rock, they'll vote for anyone over a Republican. I think the better way to assess this is to see which left-wing candidates have won their primaries against the more establishment candidates and see where do they break down. So I don't know that Tallarico is a left, especially left-wing candidate, right? Like, Tallarico's, the divide here did not come between DSA and establishment Democrats. It came between black Democrats and establishment Democrats and everyone else, like the Obama wing, right? Mamdani was more of the socialist left. That is one clear example of the socialist left winning. Since he's won, the online spaces seem to have... Since Zohran has won, the online left seems to have turned against him, which is really funny. Like, I don't get why. He's more popular than ever. He's doing a really good job, and everyone is just like, on the left-wing online spaces, is now disillusioned. And I'm like, what? Like, are you people serious? But Hutch, I don't see enough evidence of specifically the socialist wing winning a lot of primaries to say that they have enjoyed any special electoral success. They're not even at 2018. You have maybe your AOC and Zohran. Where's your Rashida Tlaib? Where is your Ilhan Omar? Where's your Cori Bush? You know, like these types of people.
I also think of the right now, the Democratic primary, when we look at the list of hopefuls, there's really only one name that comes from that wing, and it's AOC. And it's not really clear that she's going to run for president. And so I don't know who is going to be there, Bernie, in 2028, but we'll see.
I also feel like presidency talks, I think, are still, even though we're all like really obsessed with it, I feel like the presidency is a really, really long ways away. Like 2 or 3 years in U.S. politics time is like, or 2 years. It's forever. Yeah.
Okay, let's keep this train going. Okay, so this one I do want to kind of pause on, and Destiny, you go first here. Has Donald Trump made the Republican Party weaker or stronger on balance, or has he had a neutral impact?
There are a few ways to evaluate this, but I would say that Donald Trump has made the Republican Party incredibly strong in the very short term, in the way that maybe only like a culty kind of dude can. But I feel like once he's gone, I feel like it's going to be quite a bit of damage, assuming there's any Democratic candidate that could step up, or a Democratic Party that can step up and put forth a strong enough policy and messaging platform to seize the ground that MAGA is going to be retreating from. Because I don't see them having any like spiritual leaders after Trump is gone. Their policy platform is just a mess. I know debates don't usually move the American public, but like I just can't imagine in the media, like Republicans used to harp on things. You know, we have the president of peace, no new wars, and you know, obviously who knows how long we're going to be around for. I don't know how Republicans could ever use the deficit or debt talking point like for the next like decade. I'm sure they will, but that's just going to be so hard. I mean, like the ICE stuff was just, despite all the money spent, I mean, all the numbers are in fantasy land. We had the claims that eventually got to 30 million illegals came in, and they've said they've removed maybe 2 million, if you believe that. I just feel like the thing is going to be in disarray after Trump is gone, because you've got so many MAGA politicians that don't have their MAGA leader anymore. And I don't see like Vance or even Rubio stepping in to fill the gulf of Trump. So yeah, I think it gave them short term, I think, a lot of power, but at least kind of electorally where that party is, I feel like they're going to have to find their footing over a couple of years.
Okay, let me ask you guys this. Do either of you two watch sports?
Just talk to Destiny. No. I want to stay neutral here.
All right. Destiny, do you watch sports?
Hell no.
Okay. True Democrat. All right. I do.
I'm from Nebraska. So I'm used to watch college football a little bit, okay? Because I'm just from Nebraska.
Okay. So let's say this, right? Like,
okay.
Let's say you have a coach of a pro sports team who inherits an incredibly talented roster because mm-hmm. the old coach just decides to resign or says, I'm old, I'm going to retire. Osborne, and this leaving. New coach comes in.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Right. Like this new coach comes in, he's got a stacked team, right? And he guides them to the playoffs and they get bounced out in the first round. And you say, right? Like, yeah, okay. This coach has definitely taken his team to the playoffs. Did he do better than another coach would have? The question is not, did you make the playoffs? The question is, did you do better than another coach would have? It is totally possible for a coach to be successful, or a coach to be a good coach, to do a good coaching job and miss the playoffs because your team just sucks. It is possible for a bad coach to make the playoffs, to even win a championship, because your team is just that good. This is the way I evaluate Donald Trump. I do not think he is anything near what people think he is in terms of electoral strength. I think he's taken a party that, keep in mind, in 2016, anyone would have beaten Hillary Clinton except for Ted Cruz. So if you want to say he's a better politician than Ted Cruz, you won't find me arguing. But if you want me to argue that he's a strong leader for the Republican Party, that he's put him in a strong position, I would say Donald Trump took a party that was on the verge of securing 60 seats in a 2018 type of midterm, right? Like, let's say Hillary had won. Republicans would be at 60 seats in 2018 if Hillary won. Donald Trump took a party with that many structural advantages. He took a party that was poised to basically have the most advantageous state legislative situation in American history in the modern era, right? Like, Republicans were controlling state government after state government. Delaware was a f-ing tie, okay? He took that party and he's turned them into this. He's turned them into a party that is literally a 40% chance to lose Texas. I just can't look at this and say that this is a strong president. He beat the vice president of someone who presided over 8% inflation, and he beat the most unpopular nominee the Democrats had put up in 35 years. What are we talking about here? How can we say he's strong? How can we say he's made the Republican Party strong? Look at where he is. Look at where the Republican Party is. Look at everything they're about to lose. Look at his favorables. How has he made the Republican Party strong?
I don't know if you wanted to jump in there, Dustin. You look like you were mulling.
No, I think I feel like I broadly agree. I guess the only disagreement there, you would say that in the short term, he actually made them weaker. I guess it depends on what we mean by made strong or weak. One of my criticisms of, well, I shouldn't say criticism, I guess, but an observation of Trump is that I really am grateful at how stupid he is and how like incompetent and inept him and the people around him are, because they just don't believe in legislation. He doesn't know. Like, I genuinely believe, gun to my head, I don't know if he could have named the three branches of government coming in 2016. I really don't think so. I don't think he had any idea what he could do or what was within his power to do. And as a result of that, he was largely ineffective when it came to doing legislative stuff. Even the huge victory they got with abortion was granted from the Supreme Court. Like, it's just procedural stuff that he won so much on, holding onto the presidency, nominating Supreme Court justices. And then, yeah, coming around this time, man, he just doesn't care about Congress at all. I guess so. I do agree with that. Maybe it could have been that another Republican president would have won. I actually don't know the answer to that, though. Are you talking about, like, because you saw, like, head-to-head polling between, like, Rubio and Hillary, or?
Yeah, I'm talking about the head-to-head polling between Rubio and Hillary, but also the head-to-head polling between, you know, Nikki Haley and Joe Biden. Like, Haley in the New York Times polling was leading by way more against Joe Biden. We're talking about Nikki Haley. By the way, with Nikki Haley and Joe Biden, we are talking about like states like California coming down to 5 points. That's how bad the polling was for Joe Biden. I don't think it would have gotten that bad for Biden, but I am saying, like, we are talking about Biden versus Trump was always, even at the very end, like in the grand scheme of presidential elections, still like a relatively close thing that for Biden sure, was going to lose. Like, it was, you know, it was still relatively close. If it was Haley versus Trump, it would have blown out. And that's why, like, I think crediting Trump for it, when I really think it was a failure of Joe Biden, I think that's the thing where I kind of say, like, I don't think that's down to Trump, because I think another Republican would have won it and would have won by more.
In 24 or in 2020?
In 24 and in 2016. In 2020, I think it's tough, right? Like, I think another Republican would have lost by less in 2020 because every incumbent had a global incumbency bounce, basically. Every government got more popular except Donald Trump. Like, this is the one guy that managed to blow it. To Destiny's point, like, sometimes I'm incredibly grateful for just how stupid Donald Trump is, because, like, a smart Republican could probably have locked the Democrats out of power much more cleanly.
One thing I'm kind of curious about, I guess, for your thoughts on this is, like, in 2016, I'm understanding what you're saying. So one thing I don't like about head-to-head polling between people that didn't actually make it is people's feelings and attitudes, I'm sure, right, they change a lot when the election is actually happening, right? That if I were to poll for this guy, like polling Destiny against Trump, like people might have feelings about that. But if we would actually start running the race, you've got opposition research, you've got the media cycles, and everything else, that might change dramatically. I wonder if the same Republican Party, I know you're saying that head-to-head other people would have obliterated Hillary Clinton. Do you think there would have been as much motivation to turn people out, though, with the same base that ended up voting for Trump and supporting him so wholeheartedly? Do you think those same people really would have come out for Rubio or I know Cruz, you said, would lose. I don't know who else there was there. Do you really think they would have?
I'm just Kasich. Kind of
a hard, yeah. Kasich, was that 2016? Yeah, sure.
Yeah, Bush.
Yeah.
Never
That one might have actually been, that one might actually genuinely been worse. Yeah. But leaving a Bush aside and leaving a Ted Cruz aside. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Destiny, I do believe that one of them would have gotten more votes. They would not have had the same exact base, but I would say that Donald Trump has picked the single least efficient base in modern American politics. He has picked the idiot demographic. The people who do not show up to elections, the people who do not remember what elections are, the people who think that every 4 years America has one election for president of the United States and that's that, that is the group of voters Donald Trump has picked up. Okay?
You're like, not beating the coastal elite allegations there.
I live in California. I'm definitely a coastal elite. You know what? I'm proud of it. I see the palm trees from outside my backyard.
I mean, to his credit, though, right? Like, I mean, haven't the off-season elections always been, like, historically, like, abnormally terrible for the Republican Party movement under Donald Trump? Like, it feels like people just don't care. Like, these are Trump or MAGA fans. They're Trump fans. They're not Republican voters. They're there for Trump, and they'll vote down ballot, maybe. But they're not going to show up for midterm because what the fuck is even a midterm? And who the fuck cares about Congress anyway, you know, from their perspective?
Exactly, right? And like, this was not a thing under previous Republican presidents. This was not a thing under George Bush. This was not a thing under Ronald Reagan. This was not a thing even under the Obama coalition when Mitt Romney was their nominee. They had a pretty high turnout coalition. The Republican Party won white college educated voters. They won generally, they were doing very well among educated elites, and they were doing well among high engagement voters. And this whole thing about, like, you know, oh, well, Trump picked up more voters. Yes, there's no denying that Donald Trump did better than Mitt Romney did electorally. But that was more of a function of the circumstances that they faced and the fact that Mitt Romney ran against Barack Obama and, you know, Trump ran against Hillary Clinton and then an 82-year-old Joe Biden and then his vice president, basically. Uh-huh.
I do think we are limited on time, so I kind of want to cut to the chase a little bit here. Destiny, you go first. So did Donald Trump's more aggressive rhetoric on pledging to go after his political enemies, and has that sort of messaging helped him in elections and helped him overall, or has it hurt him?
It's tempting to say, so I'm going to say that it helped him massively. I think it's tempting to say that it hurt him because there were other strategies that might have been better, but I'm going to say that it helped him because I don't think Donald Trump is the type of man that could have pursued any other strategy. So if we were to imagine that, like, Donald Trump is an aggressive piece of shit, he talks about lock her up, all these aggressive things, and we're like, well, you know, if he didn't do that, imagine all the other things he could have, right, done. Maybe there's a Donald Trump that comes out and he's the one we remember in the primaries from 2016 who was like, I'm going to bring the parties together and get rid of corporate inversions in Ireland and all that. I'm going to do all these things. Maybe that Trump could have, like, been more successful. Or actually, I think that Trump had the potential to be very successful. I don't think that person exists, though. That was a mirage that we saw for days at a time in the 2016 primary season. So I feel like the only thing that fires him up are like earlier we heard that you said the three things that were energizing the Democratic base the most were the things that I feel like Trump has harped on. So culture war stuff, I feel like, carried him quite a bit because that's like a nebulous, policy-less world where you can just say whatever. You've kind of got your whole anti-establishment deep state rhetoric stuff that I feel like he can push his voters towards. And then I don't remember what the other motivating thing was, if it was the economy or affordability or something. But yeah, I feel like Trump being like an aggressive asshole piece of shit, I think ultimately ended up benefiting him quite a lot. But just because I don't know if this is a person who would be capable of engaging with his voter base or the population any other way.
I think there's merit to that point, to be clear. Like, I think Trump is who he is. he's only capable of doing this. Like, there is no other Trump. There is no tone shift that, like, incredibly gullible journalists who are desperate for an invitation to the White House Correspondents' Dinner keep falling for, right? Like, there is no other Trump. This is Trump. This is all he is. And being who he is has helped insulate him to scandals. This is the one thing where I really agree with Destiny. Trump is not strong in the objective sense of the term. Trump is actually pretty weak objectively compared to another politician. But another politician is not in the Epstein files. Another politician is not like this scandal plagued. Another politician does not have this much garbage floating around that he has managed to basically deflect. Another politician wasn't on trial for like inciting an insurrection. So like, relative to all that, just to be fair, if we're saying relative to baselines, Trump is absolutely incredibly strong compared to the amount of scandals that he has weathered. It's done damage in the absolute, but it would have destroyed any other person's career. For Donald Trump, it's basically just made him the most unpopular president in modern history, but like only a few more points unpopular than Biden for being old. So I actually agree with Destiny there. I think that Trump being who he is, it didn't help him be popular, but it has helped prevent him from sinking to a point where the entire party abandons him. And this is because, as Destiny pointed out, the Trump base is so like rapidly in favor of their candidate, of Donald Trump. They make it very clear to every Republican politician that if you cross Donald Trump, you will pay the consequences. Trump? And all of them are scared. This is not about appealing to the average voter. This is about appealing to specific slices of educated Republican voters that are, you know, terrified by Trump now.
Real quick, just to bounce on that, because I hear a lot of people, the Keys guy, Lochner? No.
Fuck.
The Keys guy. Oh, my God.
Lickman?
Lickman, yeah.
Lickman.
Something that he brought up in a conversation I had that I thought was a really good point is, you know, people were talking about the charisma key, or is he a good speaker? For some reason, Trump gets a lot of credit for things that he's not. Trump is not a charismatic president. He's, like, kind of funny, but his popularity is unbelievably low. I think the lowest ever, and then the second lowest ever is, like, Trump's first term. He is not a historically super popular guy. He's just, because he's very, very, very polarizing. So his support amongst Republicans is always at, like, 80 to 95 points for whatever reason. But independents or moderates and then Democrats hate this guy. Like, he's not comparable to, he's not like a right-wing Obama, which I think is worth noting sometimes.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, we only have 15 minutes left, and I want to get at really the heart of it. But before... So I want to ask the question, should Democrats emulate Trump's strategy of aggressive rhetoric of targeting political opposition? But before we get to that, I want to ask, how much of politics is shifting public opinion significantly or meaningfully in terms of a party or a president? How much of politics is shifting public opinion significantly versus meeting voters where they're at and running campaigns and governing in ways that accommodate the voters? And Destiny, you go ahead and go first.
So this is a really hard question to answer. Like, even psychologically, this is a hard question to answer because there's a bit of, I think it's called like stated versus revealed preference. So when people talk about the Overton window, sometimes people talk about politicians shifting the Overton window, but sometimes I wonder if it's more like discovering the Overton window. So people will say things like, Donald Trump managed to change the entire Republican Party and move them in this direction. And I do think he's done that a bit, but I think a big thing Donald Trump was discovered a Republican voter base that was hungry for stuff that so many people in the United States didn't know that they would be hungry for. So I think that, so for instance, one of the big disagreements that me and Hutch have had a lot, obviously, is how aggressive should the Democratic candidate be that's running for office next. And oftentimes I say, well, I think that it's up to the Democratic candidate to convince Americans that he should be aggressive. But part of this convincing, I think, also is partly like discovering. Like, when we talk about like the hatred for the Democratic Party, and I don't know if this comes out necessarily one-to-one in polls or if you can proxy this with other issues. I feel like one of the reasons why people just don't like the Democratic Party that much is because you don't have any strong fighters that it feels like are willing to go to the mat for you. You know, say what you will about any Republican leadership, like, it feels like they're pretty passionate about whatever they're just, if they want to kill young women who are pregnant or whatever, they want to kill immigrants or whatever, like, they feel it pretty passionately. You know, they've got politicians that are racist and do all this stuff. And then Democrats are like constantly kind of acquiescing to the gentlest rhetoric on, unfortunately, it's usually appealing to kind of the more radical left-wing people who are not electorally minded. So much of your media messaging apparatus is designed to engage with people who aren't electorally effective or voting. And then for the rest of the normal voters, you're like, well, I feel like there's just not much here for me to, I don't feel like you're fighting for me that much. And then the big issues that it feels like they do fight for are issues that are sometimes the 80-20 losing issues. So all that to be said, like in the conventional term of like where can a politician move a party, I think they can move them a lot, but sometimes those big movements aren't them moving it, but it's like discovering like where they actually are. And I feel like there's an appetite in the Democratic Party right now for somebody who's a lot more aggressive towards the Republicans. We just haven't had many people come out and explore that ground yet. That's my feeling.
So, Hutch, it's interesting because I thought this was going to be a debate between me and Destiny, but I don't really think we're disagreeing on all that much. Like, I,
yeah, just to be clear, I'm not wanting you guys to fight. I just wanted to listen to you guys talk because I thought it would be
interesting. No, yeah. I mean, I appreciate it. To Destiny, I think to your point, I'm going to build on that. I think a politician and really leaders don't really shift the grand. I don't think politics and electoral politics are the same thing, right? Like one is a subset of the other. Elections are not about changing people's minds. Elections are about following public opinion and figuring out how to win within the constraints of public opinion. Politics in general, the wider practice, some of that does involve changing public opinion, but a lot of that changing public opinion happens among your base. So Donald Trump has managed to meaningfully change the Republican Party's opinions on foreign policy, on free trade, right? Like, can you imagine in 2010, like, the Republican Party being pro-tariffs? Like, this is insane.
That's going to be my example, yeah.
Right? Like, and most of the voters who voted for Mitt Romney voted for Donald Trump, okay? Like, yes, there have been substantial changes, but on the whole, this is still structurally, in a lot of ways, a very similar Republican Party, right? They both get, like, 62% of the vote in Alabama, that type of thing. So, like, it's Donald Trump shows, in my opinion, that you can change the opinions of your own supporters tremendously. That's the value of changing public opinion. Then, to intersect with that, in my opinion, it's about figuring out and discovering what the rest of the public wants and how malleable they are towards your point of view. But really, when it's not about your base, it's about like discovering and following the wind of public opinion towards, you know, while fitting within whatever constraints you really want. The real shifting of public opinion power lies in changing the minds of your supporters. That's the part of politics that's like changing public opinion.
I think it's also on building just a little bit on, like, I think that, so when I talk about the revealed preference thing, I think sometimes we talk about a lot of proxy issues. So for instance, it's traditionally been just said that Republicans don't like taxes, right? But I don't think that it's just taxes. There's something built into the idea of taxes that you are redistributing from people who are working hard and then giving to people that aren't working hard. Like, that's actually the idea. And it's just best kind of crystallized in a progressive tax system. But there's a world where Donald Trump, if you can identify the correct enemy, Republicans are totally willing to throw taxes on them because they just see taxes as some kind of like punitive punishment thing. And if you've identified the rest of the world as trade enemies, well, now you can tax them. Like, I bet there would be an appetite in the United States for Trump to have like an immigrant tax as well. Like, if you're coming from another country, especially if you're brown or from South America, you've got to pay 5% more on your income taxes to pay for this great America that you're now welcome to. I bet you could get a surprising amount of Republicans on board with that, especially if he does it via executive order where he doesn't even need Congress's support for it. So, yeah, I think that sometimes the when you push for things and you kind of cause these changes in your base, I think you're not even really changing them as much as you think, but you could be changing them in terms of policies they're willing to accept just because of the way they're phrased and because you're hitting at some other preference that they had before that you're just like figuring out by navigating political environments with policy speeches, whatever else.
Yeah. To that end, we can just get to the meat of it here. Would it benefit Democrats electorally to shift to a more aggressive rhetoric, to be specific, rhetoric about prosecuting the current administration, taking extreme measures?
So you want to go first?
Okay, maybe we'll disagree here. I fully acknowledge, and I think that at this point in time, I don't think that would be a popular opinion among the Democratic Party, but I think there are good meta reasons for why we should message and fight for that in ways that are politically viable. Like, if it comes down to, if we message on this and, you know, we're a month out from the election and Gavin Newsom's going to lose, assuming he's the nominee, right? Then I say, okay, fine, I guess we drop it. But I think this is a point for the health of our republic. And if it were to be made as a strong enough argument for the American people, I do think a lot of positive stuff would follow afterwards, like even electorally. I think the idea of like trying a lot of these people and just showcasing in an irrefutable format, like, this is actually what happened, I think there would be a lot of value to that. I mean, morally, ethically, liberally, but then also just like for electorally as well. I think that, yeah, I'll put a pin on that there. That's what I feel. So right now, I think it's not, I don't think it would be as popular right now, but I think that it's part of our job and politicians' job to start making the argument for it and to find a way to message on it to build the popularity for it.
Yeah, so I think it's pretty dangerous to adopt a whole confrontational, we hate the other party approach. I would note that basically every popular candidate in American history has outwardly adopted a pretty conciliatory tone, right? Like most American swing voters who you need to win over do not really care much for politics. They don't love the whole idea of over-politicizing everything, right? Like Trump actually won swing voters by a surprisingly small amount considering how expensive things were and how like high prices were. So I don't think it's a great idea to double down on partisanship because generally people tend to win more when they look above the fray, like when they look like they're just too good for the whole partisan mudflinging. What I would say is I think that the way for if Democrats want to talk about prosecuting the current administration, there is a way to do that. The way you would have to do that would be about corruption. You would have to go heavy on the angle of corruption, and you would have to say, like, look, these people are literally just enriching themselves. They're making your personal economic situation a living hell just so they can insider trade with their buddies. There is a potent angle to go on that, but that does not go among a Republican-Democrat line. That is not the Gavin Newsom version of, like, you know, string up all the Republicans. It is basically a way of saying it's us, the working people, versus them. And I don't care if you're Republican or Democratic, you shouldn't be profiting off the American people. And that will also involve throwing members of the Democratic Party under the bus, right? Like taking free shots at Bob Menendez, taking free shots at existing Democratic politicians, talking, even making fun of Hunter Biden if it comes down to it, right? Like, and all of that. But there is a way. Look, the base is, the Democratic base is pretty smart. They're going to get it. Right? Like they're going to get what you mean. But if you want to talk about prosecuting the Republican Party, you really have to go for a heavy corruption approach without necessarily targeting Republicans explicitly in rhetoric. People know what that means.
I don't know if you wanted to jump in there, Destiny.
Yeah, I guess the only problem, there are two issues that I have with the corruption rhetoric. The first is that when people start talking about corruption, I'd be curious if you had polling stuff on this. The thing that scares me, this is all of this is going to parallel the Epstein conversations as well. The thing I don't like about when it comes to talking about corruption is that it's so broad and vague that I feel like any voter that cares a lot about corruption is going to think that both sides are about as corrupt as the other. Do you think that's true or do you think that's not as true? Or do you think maybe it's largely true, but it's like there's enough of a meaningful difference that like it's still worth focusing on?
It is not only absolutely true that the average voter thinks both parties are equally corrupt, it is actually the case that sometimes Republicans in our polls end up like straight up winning the vote of the people that rate corruption as their top issue, which is hilarious. Yeah. But like that is the thing. But the thing is, right, like this is one of those things where you kind of have to skate to where the puck is going and not where the puck is. You have to look at the fact that who's in power right now, right? Like corruption has not gained heavy salience. Yes, the Epstein files are big online, but like the average voter actually is not caring about the Epstein file. The average voter does not listen to stuff about the Epstein files. They don't really pay much attention to it. They find it kind of gross, distasteful, and out there. If you choose to elevate the salience, you would have to make meaningful rhetorical shifts to throw portions of the Democratic Party under the bus and say, I'm separate from them, I'm for you, but look at this administration, look at how they're in cahoots with everything that came before them to make things hard for you. I think there's a way to do it. I actually don't disagree with Destiny that like the average voter does think both parties are equally corrupt, but you can change that based on the ground circumstances that we have in front of us. And based on the material that we have, this is something where you actually can elevate the salience because it's a low salience issue. And when you raise the salience of issues, the ways in which they break tend to be more unpredictable. And there it's about using meta reasoning.
Yeah, I guess the salience issue would be scary for me because of things like when corruption was talked about so much, like the whole Pelosi stuff and the whole, like even Bernie Sanders has three houses and Ilhan Omar married her brother and is now a multimillionaire. Like, I guess I don't, it's hard to trust Americans when it comes to corruption, because you've got the criminal aspect, which there can be a lot of corruption technically without any criminal aspect at all. Like arguably like that Qatari $400 million jet to Trump, or the whole Bitcoin thing, everything he's doing. I don't know if these things are actually violative of any criminal statutes. So you'd be talking about corruption in a more abstract way. And then, yeah, I don't know. This is why I like crimes and criminal investigations. I feel like you can get a little bit more like meaty in terms of like, these are bad things that people have done, or other creative things. But I guess
that's what I wanted to do. Yeah.
But that tends to exhaust people. Sure, sorry, Hutch, okay, go on.
No, okay, you go ahead. I think you're going where I was going to try to steer the conversation.
Well, actually, wait, you can answer. Wait, you can answer this, and then, because this is my, because I know you have to leave soon, because this is going to be my response, and then just tell me how you feel about this. The only thing that scares me right now, the big issue I have, is that if we don't go adequately hard enough on Republicans in the whatever elections are coming up, that two horrible things will happen. One is the American public is going to walk away from the last decade thinking that the mRNA shots actually were killing a lot of people, and 2020 really did have a lot of really shady, horrible stuff that was happening, and yeah, the whole Russia gate and Ukraine stuff, there was a lot of bad stuff, that a lot of Americans are going to have that in their mind walking into the future, number one. And then number two, when Republican lawmakers, if they ever were to see another type of Trump figure come up, rather than looking at him and go, oh man, this might be some short-term gain, but like long-term, like really destructive to the party, or we might be able to write off this, but like, I don't know. Instead, they're going to look at it as like, oh, I'm just going to jump on that train again, because there was no penalty for doing it last time. And if this guy's even smarter than Trump, or is smart at all, because Trump has no political mind whatsoever, then they're going to be like, well, why wouldn't we just jump on board of that? Like, most Americans don't even believe on the Republican side of the results of the 2020 election. So why not? These are the two huge fears that I have, that if those were alleviated, then I'd be so much more on board with more like politics as usual. Yeah, go for it.
So I can stay for a few more minutes, Hutch. I would say, Destiny, I see that point, but you should look at 2008 for a very good parallel of this. Okay, so I want to take us back to 2008 for a second, where George Bush was waging a very unpopular war. The Republican Party was downright toxic electorally. They had really like lost their way. They nominate like a smart guy. They nominated John McCain, who, by the way, 4 years ago was so strong that he was being considered for the Democratic vice presidential nomination, right? Like the Kerry McCain ticket was a very real speculation bit that came about. They nominated a smart guy. It was not enough to overshadow the stench of the Bush administration. One of the biggest things around the Bush administration, well, two of them, were corruption and incompetence. Incompetence with Katrina, incompetence with Iraq. You know, people were like, this is, what the hell are these guys? Like, they're actually stupid. Like, stupidity is a defining American trait here, right? Like, and then beyond that, there was also the corruption angle, where people really started thinking that the Bush admin was just in it for themselves. You know, Scooter Libby was one instance of it, but really it was more about like thinking Dick Cheney and the others were enriching themselves in the Iraq war, right? Like the weapons of mass destruction, mm-hmm. Halliburton, et cetera, right? The Iran war has a lot of similar parallels here, because right now this is one of the most unpopular wars at its outset compared to any action the Republican Party has taken militarily. People keep saying, oh, Venezuela, whatever. No, Venezuela was not unpopular. This is unpopular.
Can I ask
this
you, though, just on that?
Yeah.
Because the thing that scares me is that you just gave a historical example in 2008 of all the bad things Bush did, but now I feel like Trump is rerunning that ground, except even more. So how, I feel like, doesn't this make mm-hmm. me feel worse for like a 2032 or whatever? Like, why would there not be your 2036 another guy that comes around and then runs that gamut even harder into the most horrible ways possible? Because as corrupt as Halliburton or whatever it is, I don't think that holds a candle to the World Liberty Financial or whatever, and Wyckoff and everything else. And yeah, you know, for whatever the excuse for Iraq and Afghanistan, I still don't know why the fuck we're even in Iran right now for the second time. So it's like, yeah, why would I not be afraid of that happening even worse in 10 or 15 years if that's what came from Bush that was unpopular and led to two huge Obama terms?
I think that's making a causal link where none exists, because okay. I don't think Donald Trump came about to the general American public as a direct response to George Bush. Donald Trump came around to the Republican Party as a direct thing to George Bush, but really it was about the Republican Party felt like they were lied to by their leaders and they wanted someone outside the system. They picked a guy who was extremely corrupt. They picked a guy in Donald Trump who was basically playing to all their worst instincts. But like, it's not the case that George Bush laid the foundation for Donald Trump by setting him up for XYZ. Similarly, I don't think it's the case that Donald Trump is laying the groundwork for a smarter Republican to come around in 2036, because the thing is, a lot happens in 8 years, right? Trump was 77,000 votes away from really just like being consigned to the ash heap of history forever in 2016. It was a really close election that the Comey letter probably actually swung. Like, we have real data on this. Yeah. So to me, I look at that and I say, like, focus on the next election. What happens in 10 years is unpredictable. It's a fool's errand to try to guess that now. And in the next election, like, it is an incredibly potent thing to just take the anti-corruption angle, to run that lane, to win it. And then now you have to avoid the mistakes that the Obama administration and the Obama coalition made, right? And you do have to figure that, yeah, you have to guard against the Republican Party's next big hope, because they're going to win an election again at some point, right? Like, no party wins one election forever. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that attacking Donald Trump on corruption meaningfully sets Republicans up for success in 2036. I just don't think there's a causal link to be made there. I think Trump happening in 2016 does not mean that attacking Bush on corruption in 2007 was bad. That's where I'm going.
Or I guess I'm thinking, if there would have been, and I don't know what these would look like in terms of domestic, or it would be domestic law, not international law. If there would have been real consequences for the Bush administration after Office of Special Plans lying about WMD, whatever, for the Iraq War, do you think that the Trump administration would be as gung-ho about the things that they do in Iran or other foreign policy adventures that they go on? Like, I feel like there was a lot of lack of accountability. Like, if Gore v. Bush had played out differently, of which I think Stone himself, I think, was involved in, like, on the ground riots and stuff in some of the offices, I think, in Florida related to recounts, and then was again in January 6th, right? If that media environment that was allowed to come up in that time period, I don't know how old you are, but like, I'm 37, and the meme was always like NPR are like the boring people, PBS are the boring people, and Fox News and Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and Michael Savage and Billy Cunningham, like, all of this stuff was growing and fomenting this feeling of Republicans at the time. And then there was basically no accountability for any of it coming from there. I understand that you're kind of making this argument that, well, Donald Trump maybe won or had electoral successes either despite the Bush setbacks or just unrelated to them. But I feel like I see just a lot of early seeds planted there that feel like, because there was never this huge reckoning, people were like, it wasn't as big a deal, so I don't have as horrible of a feeling about it that I'll be held accountable or something in the future. From the lawmaker and the media side, I guess. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, it was absolutely a huge mistake. It was a huge mistake from the Obama admin to not prosecute the bankers. It was a major mistake, to the point where I would actually say, you can arguably say, that was Barack Obama's biggest mistake. Because there was really an inclination from the public, like, we should go bigger on a lot of the things that Obama chose not to go for. That was his mistake. You should have prosecuted the bankers. I do think that set up a lot of what came down in the future, because the precedent was set that you can do whatever the fuck you want and get away with it. I think that was a mistake. I do think that setting the precedent of corrupt people pay the price in, you don't have to be overtly partisan doing it, right? Like, let's say John Ossoff somehow becomes president, okay? Like, let me dream for a second, and let's say John Ossoff becomes president in 2028. I don't think anyone thinks that John Ossoff is personally going to be arguing for the arrest of Donald Trump when he gets to office. He's not going to say, like, I hereby demand Trump gets arrested. What's going to happen is he would basically put up a Department of Justice person who would be like a special counsel, investigate, actually recommend serious crimes for XYZ in a way that Merrick Garland actually failed to do when there was the appetite for it. And you could make progress on that front. That, however, if it's done properly, is not something that anyone can just easily mimic. You can't just say 8 years down the line the Republican Party would mimic, because here's the world in which President John Ossoff could do that. The world in which President John Ossoff could actually say, we're setting up a special counsel to look into this, is one in which, like, Trump and his cronies are all like negative 30 in popularity. That's to the point where even a future Republican president says, F- these guys, I don't want anything to do with them.
Lockshaw, I don't mean to interrupt, but like, can you do it improperly and then still have a mandate from the public? So if Donald Trump pardons himself and Newsom decides to take extra legal measures, can someone like that do that and then not just collapse with the public? Is that plausible?
That's where my expertise stops. I don't know if I can even speculate on that, because I don't know how it would play out. At that point, we're just shooting in the dark, right? Like, I do know that if Trump pardoned himself, it would be the most unpopular move done by any president since Richard Nixon. That I can tell you. I don't think there would be as much of a consequence for Newsom saying that I believe these pardons are null and void, and I will be asking the Supreme Court this question. I don't even know what type of scenario would lead to, you know, like an extra legal measure, or like what those measures would be. So I can't say that it would or wouldn't work. But anyways, I think that basically wraps up my time, but it was a pleasure to be here with you guys. So thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on, buddy.
Yeah, thanks a lot, man. I appreciate the talk.
Yeah, what are your thoughts? I mean, I don't know if you have something else going on.
No, not right now. I don't know. I mean, I feel like I agree with most of what he said. Yeah.
I mean, listen, I enjoy those conversations. I mean, I like sparring with you and screaming at you and everything like that and going back and forth in that way, but I do like those conversations a little bit more. So,
sure.
You know, I just, he was much more qualified than I was to get into the electoral specifics. Uh-huh. And so, you know, I just wanted to see you guys bounce back and forth.
Yeah.
But,
Also, I think there are some fights that are worth having. I think it's okay to scream about some things. And then I think there are some fights that aren't worth having. So, yeah. What does a future Democratic administration look like insofar as how does it approach the prior Republican one? I think that's a fight worth having. I don't think there's, like, necessarily, despite sometimes how my community or maybe even you might feel, I think it's not like everything you say is stupid and I disagree wholeheartedly with everything. I think a lot of these are kind of like edge case or like narrowly decided arguments where there are things that could shift my opinion. I imagine there might be things that could shift your opinion a lot more than like we need to argue whether or not tomorrow we need to instate Medicare for all and abolish all private insurance and also do a 50% wealth tax or whatever. Like I would consider that like a pointless argument. This is a stupid thing to even discuss. Yeah.
If you had to give odds, I just want to know, like right now in this moment, if you had to give odds in terms of the Republic surviving past 10 years, what would you say? Surviving as it is, I mean,
I have no idea. You know, there was a saying that I don't know if it was Marx or Lenin or somebody said this, but like an American can sooner imagine the end of the world than the death of capitalism or something. Like it's really hard for me to even say. There was also a discussion I had earlier with, do you know the guy at North, a Republican guy, kid?
22. He's come in my Discord a couple times, yeah.
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 There's also, we were discussing earlier and I was saying that like, I think when there's like the death of a democracy or a republic, it's probably like a recession. You know how you have to be 2/4 of negative GDP growth in order to declare a recession, or maybe they've changed it, whatever. But like, you don't really know until it's kind of already happened. Like, there's not going to be like, oh my God, tomorrow the republic is dying. It's going to be like, tomorrow something terrible happens. You're like, ooh. Like if Trump were to, I think the argument I made was that if Trump were to stop the midterms somehow, he finds a way for 3 or 4 states to just not have their midterm elections, then people would look and say the republic kind of died in like, maybe it started in like 2015 when Obama had his Supreme Court pick robbed from him. Or maybe it even started all the way back with like Bush v. Gore when the Supreme Court found a way to stop a lawful recount. Or maybe it was 2016 or 2020. You know, I think they would look back. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I try to have high hopes, but I'm also kind of naive in that I can't really fathom a world where we don't live in a democratic republic. So, yeah.
Yeah, maybe you're talking about something like Hungary. I don't really know too much about them, but my understanding is that they kind of slowly backslid more and more. And, you know, it's not like a full-on dictatorship, but not the healthiest democracy.
Yeah.
I guess the reason why I feel a little bit more bullish on America is because, frankly, there's a lot of people like you right now that are, you know, I would argue are a little radicalized in this moment, but certainly hyper-vigilant. And so, you know, I don't know what Hungary's domestic situation was. Like El Salvador, for example, that guy is dictator, like just a full-on dictator, but he's super popular. My fiance has family in El Salvador and they love that guy. Uh-huh. And you know, it kind of makes sense. Like he consolidated power and, you know, aggressively took on the cartels, at least optically, although I think there's some reporting to suggest he might be working with the cartels in some capacity. But in America, I see a very, very hyper-polarized country where there's a, I mean, there are tens of millions of people that are like really primed right now and really energized. And I think if you were to do something like an aggressive move to try to steal the midterms, I would never say that he would never try to do something like that. I think maybe the difference between you and I right now is like, I do have, as much as the courts have been compromised by Trump, I do have faith that they would not let him just steal the midterms. And if he did do something and he did get away with it and he did just, you know, tell the courts to get, I do think the American people would respond very, very forcefully. I think they would shut everything down.
Yeah, that might be the case. But again, I think we're hitting on this fundamental disagreement. Like, my issue is that I feel like by the time you're testing those boundaries, you've already kind of lost yourself. You've like, something is already, I'm not going to say irredeemably or fundamentally broken, but it's just like, that's just not a world where you've got a healthy functioning democracy. Like, oh, like, why is your democracy so good? Well, because the American people, by popular vote, elected a president that literally tried to, like, actually literally prevent midterms from happening. It's like, how the f*** did you get there? It's like, well, the last time he left office, he tried to coup the government, but it failed. It's like, what the f***? Like, by the time we're winning these small battles, it's like, yeah, we managed to fight this thing off. It's like, bro, you, the fact you're even having this fight, you've already completely lost, you know? Maybe not completely, but that's kind of how I view it. Like, I don't want to rely on the judiciary to protect my elections. And we'd be relying on them with, like, not good rulings, but with, like, preliminary injunctions or temporary restraining orders. Like, that would be the hope there. Because rulings take years, and by then the damage could already be done. Like, it has been for things like USAID or the Department of Education or all the people who are deported now that are never going to come back, even though they weren't supposed to have been deported, or, the, you know, people like Renee Good or Alex Preddy or our treaties or relations, other, like, all these things, like, the damage has been, sorry, I'm getting dimmer, but yeah, you know.
No, I mean, I was just talking to Soypill right before we started this, and he was expressing similar things. And I guess in a broad sense, and I definitely don't want to mischaracterize anything that anyone says. I would appreciate if people didn't do that. I'm not saying you do, but but in an effort to understand your position on a more macro set, in a more macro sense, it does kind of sound like you're suggesting that because of whatever reasons, the media environment is f***ed and blah blah blah, and there's just not enough disincentivizing factors for things like just outright lying in the media. In fact, you can make millions of dollars lying. It's really f***ed. And it sounds like you're saying that we can't really trust the voters to make to not make this mistake in the future, or not perhaps elect somebody even worse than Donald Trump in the future. Therefore, the current system right now is not tenable. And so we need to consider the possibility of scrapping the system, at least temporarily.
Yeah, I would say that's almost exactly what I believe, what you just said. Yeah. I think that there's, I think there are fundamental aspects of the nature of, like, how media works. I'm starting to write some things down for changes I think would have to happen, but the media environment is a whole other thing in and of itself. Like, if somebody were to spitball a law that would say, like, by tomorrow, we're going to make special classifications for, like, news things, so, like, news entities, news organizations, or whatever, and from now on in social media, you're no longer allowed to algorithmically generate news. That's just banned. You're not allowed to do that. You can do it for culture stuff or whatever else, but no more news-related stuff. Like, I think we need to start taking drastic measures like this to claw our way back to sanity. Because the reality is that the average voter has never been able to navigate all of these issues ever. We've always relied on kind of the media to do it for us. Because the average person is working 9 to 5, is not coming home, and it's like, time for me to read up on the Shah and the Ayatollah and what's going on with Iran. Like, it's not going to. But, like, when you turn on the media and the people who are giving you the information about this are, you know, Ketamine Musk and Joe Manlet Rogan, these are the people who are informing you about the world. Like, that situation is untenable. Voters won't survive, not because they're bad people, but just because you can't. And we know this intuitively when it comes to building environments for us, right? Like, if you had cookies and everything all over the house 24/7, you're gonna get fat. You just have to not have the cookies in the house. And that's true of our current media environment as well, I would say. Yeah,
but it sounds like to me that you're making the case for reforms.
Yeah, that's on the reform side of things. I do think there have to be big brave reforms done with our media stuff and everything, for sure. Those are all reform things.
But before we get there, you would entertain the possible remedy of maybe suspending, like, the system almost entirely to make sure that these bad actors can't hold office again.
Well, I mean, it depends on how you view suspending the system. But I think there's another fundamental disagreement. I don't think you don't have to suspend the system. You can do whatever you want in the current system while following all the rules. it would just be a bad faith engagement with the rules that you would consider suspending the system, but they wouldn't be. but I don't know how to ever convince you of that. For some reason, there's like a one box, two box thing. For some reason, they're like in your brain, you cannot, I don't know why, but I feel like you cannot comprehend that thing.
I comprehend it theoretically. And I think,
okay, let me give a concrete example. Tomorrow, let's say I know the Supreme Court has to write a ruling on whether or not abortion is going to be legal everywhere or whatever. And I, as the president of the United States, decide to send federal agents or marshals or whatever else to go kidnap six of the Supreme Court justices, the conservative ones, and then hold them in a jail cell while I know that Supreme Court decision is being written. That's completely and totally within the purview of my job as president of the United States. The Supreme Court has guarded and ruled it as such. There's absolutely nothing there that violates the current system of legal protections we have in the United States. But that would obviously be a bad faith engagement with the system. But you admit that would be a wholly legal thing to do, right?
No, I don't. Because those Supreme Court justices have constitutional protections. So you can't just...
I'm talking about constitutional protections. We would be using the intelligence services to round them up and hold them for a little bit. We could say they're national security issues that we think we're going to investigate them for. And then you wait till the ruling is out, then you release them.
I mean, sure.
This is the thing that gets so... Listen, I don't want to... This is so frustrating. You're laughing at this. Not theoretically. That is the current norm in the United States of America, is decisions that the president of the United States makes that is exclusive and preclusive within his power is beyond review from any court or any other person in the entire United States. This is the whole Trump v. USA or whatever case.
Well, you know, exploring his... like what he can do sort of like immediately... with his authority, he can order people to do this thing or that thing. But it is certainly not the case that the current norm is that we arbitrarily detain judges if we suspect they're going to hand down a ruling that would hamper our agenda.
Well, sure. That's... I'm sorry, when I say no, what I mean is that you're not violating any type of, like, there's nothing illegal about that. It would be perfectly within Hutch's like liberal framework that's totally allowed by the current system. There's nothing illegal about that. The Supreme Court has issued a ruling. This is beyond... he's got plenary authority when he's acting exclusively preclusively than the role of the president. It's beyond judicial review.
Well, I imagine within the boundaries of our system, these Supreme Court justices would challenge this detainment in a court, and it would then be deemed as invalid. And at that point, you would have to release them. And
they
would just hand down the same decision, right?
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have used the word jail or prison. They wouldn't be arrested. They would just be kidnapped. You're not arresting them, putting them in jail. When I say jail, it's not like some temporary holding.
Like rendition them to like a CIA black site or something like that.
Or it could just be Trump's basement in Mar-a-Lago. I don't know. Just hold them there for a while. Not an actual formal arrest. You just get the intelligence agents to round them up for a little bit. Or it could be for a black site, but not a formal arrest. But whatever it is, it doesn't matter because the president has the ability to conduct himself in a manner that is beyond judicial review for any of those actions that are within his exclusive purview as presidency. And they can't even be probed for... you can't even probe him for his motivation on any of it. Even that's illegal. So...
well, I think the issue here is that you're characterizing that as, you know, perfectly fine within the current system. And I would argue that that is definitely well outside of the system. Like, you can try to assert certain authorities and declare that he's above any kind of judicial review.
No.
But at that point, you are...
that the president has already been declared above judicial review when it comes to actions that he's taking. You can say that this would be above Hutch's system, but I'm talking about for American liberal democracy as it exists right now, that would be allowed and unreviewable in our current system in the United States of America. Maybe not in your, what you would prefer, but that is the letter of the law right now in the United States of America.
Well, like a fundamental pillar of American liberal democracy is you have these co-equal branches of government that serve as a check against concentrated power. And so if your remedy is to assert presidential authority and then rendition, you know, possibly a rendition Supreme Court justices to a black site, what mechanism can the court constrain the president then?
None. What do courts typically constrain the president with? It's through criminal review? Or through... Congress could pass a new law. No, it would have to be a constitutional amendment. But if the Supreme Court themselves wrote themselves out of the judicial review aspect of that, so then the only alternatives you would have would be maybe impeachment by the Congress, although the president could just rendition Congress members that were going to vote for his impeachment. Or you could have a new law or a constitutional amendment being passed that would allow you to write legislation to inhibit the powers of the president. But with the way the Supreme... or you could... I'm sorry. You could also pack the court and then get them to do a new Supreme Court ruling, I guess. That would be another thing.
Well, that would be, you know, I think that would be vastly preferable to renditioning to, Alito to a black site and
Sure.
Fucking I'm not,
my
something.
Point is not like these are ideas that I think would be amazing or great. I'm just saying that within our current system, you all of these things are completely and totally legal. There's not a hint of illegality in any of the things I just said. All of this is like, you can bring on Pisco or you can bring on that one loser, any of Pisco's lawyer friends that are all conservative, crazy people. The Ryan Mullaly guy, like he'll talk around it to try to not admit that it's as bad as it is, but this is all completely and totally allowed in the United States.
Right, but I guess when you propose these kinds of things, my mind wants to like flesh it out as much as possible. Sure. And while these might seem like things that would, you know, effectively get you closer to your goal or accomplish your goal, I don't see them surviving very long. Like, I don't think that this would be something that would like play out in a way that is that provides these permanent solutions or semi-permanent solutions. I think that would very logically mean that the president would just like lose their grip on power pretty quickly, I think. And you're just back at square one. And so I think
I kind of agree with that. Like these, like I'm like, there would be some things I think that should be exceptionally done for the current administration, but the vast majority of the work, and realistically what all the work is going to be, is just going to be on reforms going forward. Ideally, yeah.
That's the case, then, you know, it seems like we agree.
Well, I've said this before, like any reform that you're going to push for, I would want that, I imagine, but I just a little bit more to hold the past people accountable. But in terms of like real reform environment,
a little bit more.
I'm saying I would push past to do the reforms that I would want would be massive. So I don't even know if the crazy actions as president would even be much compared to, but I think you would maybe even probably agree. Like we need like crazy massive changes in how our media environment functions, right?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, typically the mechanism that you would use for what's provided for in the system would be, you know, I think in the case of the media stuff, it might be a constitutional question. And mm-hmm. at that point, it's about building consensus. And, you know, that is probably a long-term goal. I mean, Lockshire kind of touched on it a little bit. If Donald Trump did something that dropped him down into like the teens of approval and, you know, it really was just a massacre, then you can have, that's like an FDR style mandate. And you can permanently change the system pretty much right away. But,
maybe, but like, I'm curious. Oh, this would be a good question for, I keep wanting to call him Lochner. What's his name? Say it again. Pronounce it again.
Lockshire.
Okay.
Yeah.
Or Lochner. Too many people on YouTube. I'm curious what he would say. I hope I'm wrong on this. Just vibing it right now. I don't think the next presidential election, I don't think it's going to be a blowout. I think it will come down to swing states again. Unfortunately, I think we'll win and it'll be a thing where people are like, oh, we swept, but I think we'll sweep like Trump swept before, where it's like we win maybe like even all the swing states, but man, I would have hoped it would have been like a Reagan tier landslide victory. I don't think we're going to get that. I think that the institutions are too powerful right now that protect Republican governance, like the way the Senate works, the Electoral College, whatever else.
I think you're right. I mean, I think that the odds are better that it's going to be another kind of close-ish election, but I wouldn't rule out the possibility of something kind of transformative, because I genuinely think that Donald Trump is sundowning, and I genuinely think that he's surrounded himself with incompetent sycophants, and that administration leaks like a sieve. So, you know, if they do get into some like real, I just feel like everything leaks to the press, you know, and right now we're a bit hamstrung because Republicans are the, you know, the Congress is supposed to serve an oversight role, and they're just abdicating that role completely because they're, you know, cult of personality now. But when we take back the Congress and can actually use congressional powers to subpoena this administration and highlight, like, I do think like it is possible that you could end up with like rebuilding a pretty massive coalition. That's an outside chance. I think what you're proposing is probably more likely. It'll be swing states and, you know, like sure. not necessarily a modest victory, but
yeah. Another thing that sucks about the big coalition you want to build, or not you, but that we would want to build, is it does feel like a lot of those issues that are kind of like bipartisan, those moments end up just hitting both parties, which is very annoying to me. Like the Epstein stuff or like corruption stuff, yeah. Like people that feel strongly on these issues. But then, you know, like I said, maybe if we raise these to salience, maybe you can message on it better. I'm not sure.
But well, I think that touches on your media problem. It's because there's this sloppulism is just really ascendant right now. And
yeah, but you would have to win the elections before fixing the media problem. Because whatever media solution that I want to implement, it's going to be heavily partisan in appearance, right? Like, remember when Republicans used to complain all the time, like, why do we get hit for so much stuff related to misinformation, blah, blah, blah? The thing that nobody was ever brave enough to say was that it's because you motherfuckers lie more. So whatever reforms I'm talking about implementing is going to hit them way the more than it would hit us.
Yeah.
And then to the average American, it seems like, oh, you're just being politically biased or partisan. I was like, well, or maybe these motherfuckers just lie more, like we don't want to say. But it would be a hard, you'd have to get the coalition first, yeah.
I mean, nothing about this, I think, is fair. I do think that institutionally and the media environment is slanted in favor of Republicans like that. And that is like a really difficult thing to contend with. But I don't know. I feel like we're touching on something that Ezra Klein was. I mean, I'm curious. Did you watch the Ezra Klein discourse play out when he was proposing, like, his whole thing on top of the abundance stuff was the idea that he's actually, like you, he's not content with small majorities. Like, he wants a big enough coalition to, you know, do transformative legislation and do transformative reforms. And in order to do that, you do have to sit down in a room with a bunch of smart people and think, okay, what does that coalition look like? You know, you're probably going to need states like Ohio and Iowa and Texas and Florida. Uh-huh. And so then it becomes a strategy of how do you rebuild that coalition? And he got into some hot water because he proposed the hypothetical pro-life thing, yeah. But that was just, yeah. I mean, it was a throwaway example. I don't think he meant to.
I agree. I think his argument there was good, but the abortion example was just the worst example. It was like he picked literally the worst possible thing that he could have ever picked. It's like, we need to build a coalition with libertarians, guys. We got to be able to give on something. What about the age of consent to zero? It's like, why, of all the things, why, this is the one thing,
it should have been. It should have been fracking,
literally anything
gun,
else.
Gun,
yeah,
gun control.
Could
have
been literally
yeah.
any other issue. And he was like, pro-life. It's like, Jesus Christ. It's like one of the most salient, most popular, easiest issues to mess around. But no, yeah, I agree. And it's just, go ahead.
Well, I don't know. You know, that's curious to me because you say that's a good argument, but that involves kind of the opposite of what you're saying, like moving away from the hyper-partisanship. So you think it's a good argument, but
why not try to be partisan in terms of supporting like just one side or the other? Like, I view the whole MAGA thing in this administration, these are like uniquely bad things that are it's above partisan politics. These are like evil, anti-democratic, illiberal people. Whatever you build in the future, like, does have to have, like, you need to have a broader party that can message to different cohorts. Like what Zohran Mamdani says, or what AOC says, like, these people have gotten much better at picking up, or Zohran has been good since he's been elected. And then AOC's gotten better at like saying, we need to have different politicians around the country to build stuff. I agree with that. Anything that Ezra says or anything that you believe on that, I'm going to believe that. But I think that, I don't know if that's mutually exclusive with saying like everything associated with this current admin is so unbelievably corrupt and tainted. And if there was another thing that I think could sway me from my position, is like if there was just some way to make the American people realize that. But I think that I feel like escaping without consequences, it just vindicates so much of the behavior, and it sets it up so much in the future for like, well, if they can do it and get away with it, like if we have the chance to secure some wacky and wild and crazy shit, why not do it again? Like, you would agree that like a current Republican Senate majority would absolutely steal another Supreme Court pick if they had the ability to do it, right?
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, to be fair, I mean, wouldn't you want the Democratic Party to do the same at this point? If the roles were reversed, if it was a Republican president, and let's say they win the midterms, they win control of the Congress and both chambers, and Alito dies, you know, would you want Schumer to hold that seat open for 2 years?
I mean, I would say 100%. Yeah. I don't know if you would feel that way. You really think you'd be on board with that?
1,000, 100,000. I would be on board if it was 4 years.
Okay, based. Yeah, I mean, I would, but that would be a hugely norm-breaking. Wait, hold on. Ready? Would you be in favor of that if it looked like there was a midterm coming up and it looked like we were going to lose Senate seats?
That depends. How many Senate seats? I mean, the Supreme Court's really important. So, I mean, that's an interesting question. Mm-hmm. But are we talking like a blowout, like 30, we lose 30 seats? Or are we talking we lose 3 seats?
I mean, just the majority, I guess, to play the game of not packing the... What if the SCOTUS nominee for us was going to be Epstein, but if the Republicans won, it was going to be Hassan Piker? I'm just kidding. I'm sorry.
I just made it past that discourse. Yeah. The replies stopped trickling in, and you're going to rekindle the whole thing.
That like in 10 years, in 20 years, like I think people are going to speak about the COVID time, that there was legitimately like a one world order government And it's not going to be like the crazy Illuminati people that were like the Alex Jones fans like 15 years ago that were like 1% of the population. It's going to be the Alex Jones fans that are like 50% of the population. The people are going to say the 2020 election was legitimately highly contentious. Like that's like, because like when people come into power, when dictators come into power, when you listen to Putin talk about Russia, when you listen to when Hitler, you know, was advertising for his little Nazi group and they were all trying to come to power in Germany, like controlling history is so important because history is where you can derive all of your moral authority from. And then it gives you the stories and it gives you the right to act in whatever ways that you want. So if you can, you know, cast somebody as the villain historically, then in modern day, you can, they're your villain now. If you can cast somebody as being wronged in the past, they get have righteous anger now. Like you'll see this even in contemporary politics where they'll say, well, the Democrats always did this, so that's why, you know, we can do this and everything. And yeah, I just have it, I worry that all of that history, if we don't pursue something aggressive, that it's going to be seen as like, it'll be remembered as genuinely contentious when it wasn't contentious. It was just one-sided wholesale corruption. That bothers me.
It bothers me too. The thought of that very much bothers me. It sounds like you and I are fully in agreement that probably, I mean, arguably the biggest problem in this country right now is we have an electorate where a lot of people, and I'm not going to judge them too harshly, okay? Because some people are lazy. Some people have all the time in the world and they just, you know, they have no excuse. But there's a lot of people that have families and they're working full time. And I don't have kids. And so I genuinely don't think I have the right to judge people for not being super informed. But like, how do you incentivize the country, the electorate, the people, to pay more attention and to parse their information through more reliable sources? And it seems like that question is becoming more and more challenging to answer by the day. I think the alternative media landscape right now is like 100 times worse than, you remember when all the anti-mainstream media stuff like reached its peak during 2016, the corporate media and other, like the situation right now with alternative media, in my opinion, is like literally 100 times worse because there are no guardrails there. There's no editorial standards. There's the opposite incentive to lie. People like Tim Pool knowingly lies every day. Mm-hmm. He's just fully lying. He's doing it for money.
Even about friends. That Charlie Kirk tweet, sources tell me he's stable. That was a lie. He just said it for clicks. There's no universe where anybody said that to him.
Like, maybe. Yeah. No. But that, I mean, that is a very, very vexing challenge. And I agree that there would have to be some significant systemic change to address that, because I don't know how we could survive. I'll join you in saying, I don't know how we survive as a republic if this problem just keeps getting worse. And so I leave it to better minds to figure out what those reforms look like and how to get there. But that is, I mean, if you can figure out how to make, you know, 50, 60% of the country, just pay attention. It doesn't even need to be a lot, like 1 or 2 hours a week, just reading the news from reliable sources. And we would have like that meme, you know, society if JFK was never killed or whatever.
To be fair, though, on that point, like Americans could probably consume a lot less media than they do. But like they could consume the same amount now. If it was of a higher quality, we would probably have the most informed voter base on the planet. Like,
true.
I don't have a way of proving this, but it wouldn't surprise me if Americans consume more news related media now than they ever had in the past. Like, could you imagine back in our day trying to get like an 18-year-old to listen to like a 4-hour politics, literally anything? Like, even the Daily Show, was the Daily Show 30 minutes or an hour long?
It was 30.
30 minutes. But now you've got young men, 15, 16, 17, listen to 4-hour Joe Rogan podcasts on essentially politically adjacent issues, right? So we consume so much media today. It's just so horrible. But I think that, like, go on.
Well, I was going to say, like, I think there are times in the past where maybe more people were paying attention than even now with our phones, because they had only, you know, two or three sources for the news. Like, everybody watched like one or two anchors. And when there was some big thing going on, like landing on the moon or the Cuban Missile Crisis or, you know, like radio broadcast during the war, you know, you probably had a very high level of engagement. Mm-hmm. There's certainly probably like people are probably spending more time engaging in political stuff these days. But the quality of the stuff that they're engaging with is just utter and complete trash. And it's making people dumber. Yeah. It's like actively making them dumber.
Yeah, I agree. Because it's dividing our world more and more and more into these unrealities that both sides exist in. Yeah. Or, you know, like, because it's so hyper curated to just exactly what you want to see. Whereas, like, in the past, there might have been something that upset you on the news, but, like, it's the news, it's what's going on. You kind of have to watch it, you know? And so, you know, there might be different flavors of it, but for the most part, you kind of have to see the same events. Whereas these days, you remember the January 6th Select Committee, right?
Yeah.
Fox News didn't even broadcast that. So if you were a Fox News viewer, you wouldn't even know that, you know, you would have never even seen that on TV. And then, you know, when it comes to online media, you know, it's this issue times a trillion, right? You've seen I'm sure the memes from my community and in front of the media and everything else where you go the whole, like, I haven't heard of that. I've never heard of that. I don't know anything about that. It's like, how the f*** do you not know anything about that? Donald Trump, when asked about the, you know, that the tomahawk that hit the school, it's like, oh, no, I don't know anything about that. How can you not know anything about that? This would have never been an acceptable answer before. But yeah.
How much of this problem do you think necessarily needs to come from politics or policy? Like, or in other words, is there a different way to incentivize people to not only become more engaged, but be more diligent about the sources that they go to for information? Is there some kind of social consequences that we could start to, you know, like how much of it can come from culture or the arts or, you know, things outside of politics?
I think there are cute things you could do culturally, but for the most part, it's you're going to be a slave to the system you're in. But Americans especially, nobody really likes to think that, but Americans especially don't like to think that. But I mean, it's just true. If you put somebody in a bad environment, and when you're talking to your kids and everybody else, everybody knows this, garbage in, garbage out, you are who you hang around. What do these grind bros say? You're like the sum of your 10 best friends or whatever, or the average of your 10 best friends. Like it's not your net worth, it's your network. Right? Like everybody has sayings for this, but for some reason, when it comes to politics, we shut our brains off. And it's like, actually, the human mind is capable of swimming through an infinite sea of intellectual garbage to find the nuggets of truth. I was like, why the fuck would we think that?
Don't you think when I look back on the first Trump term and the beginning of Biden's term, it seemed like we were kind of moving closer to that, where you had these social media platforms that I don't think they were doing it because it was the right thing to do. I think they were doing it because, you know, they were getting pressure from their corporate sponsors. But, you know, we did have social media platforms that started to implement policies of, you know, banning people for misinformation and these kinds of things. And now we find ourselves in this pendulum swing away from that, like where I don't know if that avenue to do it in that kind of way is going to open again anytime soon.
The issue, and I think I agree, unfortunately, with Laksha, is that Americans like to feel, you know, I make fun of the centrists for this, but really all Americans like to feel like they're above partisanship. And having a political leader who's just like constantly attacking one side, I don't think plays well with a lot of Americans. But the issue is that like any information or any conversation that we have about information, truthfulness on the internet or whatever, this is going to be just, it's going to be hyper-partisan. There's no way to get around that. So like you said before, like, well, weren't social media sites starting to crack down on misinformation? Yeah, but what happened, right? Most of it was coming from the Republicans. So as soon as Trump comes in, all these conservatives are like, I can't believe that they banned me just because I said that I think COVID was created by people in a lab to infect all Americans, except for the Jews for some reason. And I don't know why they made it in China, but whatever. You know, like that, like almost all of this or a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it was targeted towards conservatives. So they felt like they were being targeted. So any new system that we implement to curb misinformation is going to dramatically fixate on one side. Because right now, conservatives are just on the wrong side of like factually of so many things in reality. Holy f***.
Okay, I'm going to give you my cringest take yet. And I want you to give me your thoughts. Okay. What are your thoughts on AI? Do you use ChatGPT or Claude or anything like that?
I guess I accept it a little bit more now in my Google searches, but in general, I don't think I'm opposed to it. I'm just a lazy adopter, I think. Oh, you're going to say that AI is going to get us out of a lot of this, maybe?
To be clear, AI, there are a lot of, like, this is a perilous kind of path we're on. There's tremendous potential for really massive disruption that can hurt a lot of people. And if we don't aggressively address this with policy, then, I mean, the results could be very dystopian. However, you'd agree that like millennials and older, we're probably going to be more resistant to AI than the younger generation, right? Like they're just kind of raised with this. And so they're not questioning it in the same way that we are because that's just normal to them, right? Like
depends on what you mean by resistant. I think I would disagree, but I think we would agree at the end based on your phrase. It like, I think older people are more susceptible to newer technology. They just are later adopters of it. So like, yeah, like I would look to the boomer generation right now. I feel like the number one consumers of fake bullshit are boomers and Gen Xers on social media platforms. Holy fuck.
Yeah, but they're getting their bullshit from, I think, Facebook. I think we do have polling that younger generations are more open to AI, but I could be
they might be more open to AI, but I bet they're less likely to be tricked by it because they either don't believe all of it or they're just a bit more adept at picking out like the fake news. Whereas for boomers, I don't know if these guys have any idea of what's real or not real for anything anymore.
Just a bad LSD fever dream for boomers now. My dad just stares at his phone for probably 10 to 14 hours a day, like literally.
Yep.
Just
yeah, I've heard you say that before, phone, yeah. So. I remember 10 years ago, 10 or 15 years ago, I remember telling my chat this story, or maybe it was like 10 years ago, my mom told me, because I asked her about like, oh, did you see this on Glenn Beck? My mom was like, oh, I don't really watch Fox News anymore. And I was really happy for like a week, but I didn't realize until about a week later that she'd completely replaced all of her Fox News consumption with just Facebook consumption.
Just freebasing,
yep.
Like boomer Facebook
horrible,
memes and stuff.
Horrible yep. Facebook things. Oh my God, yeah.
But I think the potential for AI, like acknowledging all the potential catastrophic outcomes, is if they are truly perceived as nonpartisan, that might be tricky because, you know, just like maybe your dad might dismiss an article you send him because it's a CNN article, mm-hmm. You might be able to program people similarly to be as distrustful as of AI because of, oh, that's owned by Sam Altman. He's a big lib or something like whatever, you know. But I do think that there's potential there to facilitate fact-checking in a way that doesn't have the same kind of partisan baggage that certain mainstream media outlets or now alternative media pundits have. And so that is kind of interesting to me, you know, that is kind of interesting
saying,
to me.
But I think, unfortunately, I think it's a more fundamental question of, I talk about friction, like in life, we just try to reduce the amount of friction and discomfort we have, which in some ways is good, right? You want to wear shoes so you're not cutting up your feet every time you walk outside, and you want to have like a blanket so you're not shivering in your sleep. But when it comes to like challenging yourself intellectually, sometimes we choose frictionless environments too quickly.
Right.
And AI can facilitate that, or AI can counter that. So it really, no matter how sophisticated the AI is, given the opportunity to choose between an AI that caters to my desire for a frictionless news media environment versus one that creates a lot of friction, people are just going to gravitate towards the algorithm that favors their what makes them feel good, which is the same as the algorithm
yeah.
now, unfortunately. I do agree there's a potential for good fact checking, but like you see how much people fight with Grok now, whereas before Grok was like the fucking
yeah.
Holy Roman Empire of fact checking. Yeah.
You have to address the underlying motivations. And so it's difficult to, I think maybe it gets easier as you get older and life humbles you a little bit more, but I think it's generally good practice when you hear some claim to rigorously check the claim. And if you're going into an argument about policy, it's a good idea to like look up what the counter arguments are. And not only that, but like try to have an open mind, which is like, you're not going to be able to do that perfectly because everybody has bias, but uh-huh. You know, you can do a good job of allowing for new information. And if you have somebody who is motivated purely by a desire to confirm those biases, then doesn't matter if it comes from AI. So I take your point. So like, then that becomes a different challenge. Like, how do you incentivize a change in the culture? How do you create a culture where that kind of curiosity and that kind of open-mindedness is rewarded? Like, I think like the podcast space, they claim to be doing that. It's bullshit. It's like very nakedly partisan in a right-wing bend, you know, but I think that appeals to people, right? Like I think a lot of people that listen to Rogan's podcast or some of these other like intellectual dark web people or whatever, I don't know if they even still call it that. I think they do think that they're satisfying that kind of like nonpartisan curiosity without knowing that they're just like, you know.
But think about how they were able to do it. They do it by creating frictionless environments. Now, they wear the aesthetic of being a challenging environment, but like I just listened to Joe Rogan, Constantine, and the mute next to him. Like, they were crying for like 20 minutes because I asked Constantine how to define a word. And Constantine has blocked me now on Twitter as of today because I roasted him over it. And these are people who pride themselves on having open conversations with anybody. The one guy, the Muppet guy, even said on the show, he's like, well, we wish that we could find leftists to have good, challenging conversations with, but it's literally just impossible. And it's like, you guys have created the biggest hug box in the world. Like, Joe Rogan just had Andrew and Rachel Wilson on. Like, one of these people is literally a delusional satanic cult believer, and the other is Andrew Wilson. I'm not even joking when I say that. Like, these people are crazy, but they have like this somehow this allure of being like the centrist people. But they did it by creating a frictionless environment. People like Hassan are the same way, right? Like, he doesn't really platform views that are opposite his. The only time he addresses criticism is when he's screaming at like one person in chat. Every now and then he'll drag a 14-year-old Israeli into debate because he thinks he can win that conversation, or a commentary YouTuber. But for the most part, frictionless has just been the way that everybody has been trending. Trump is the same as well, right? Like, they don't go on news media outlets and answer questions they don't like. How many times now is Trump, like, how many times has Trump just full out like insulted a journalist because they actually ask him a hard question? Right.
Thousands.
It's insane. It's unbelievable, right? Compared to Obama going on, you know, all these different Fox News shows and doing interviews and stuff. It's just like, it's just incomparable. But people love those environments.
I think the through line between everybody that you just mentioned, Constantine, Hassan, and Trump, is all three of them are just blatantly dishonest. Like, there was a moment in your debate with Constantine where I think you were pressing him on, like, how many left-wing voices.
Oh, sorry, God.
No, I think you were pressing him on, like, how many left-wing voices have been on their platform in the last, like, I don't know, few years, however you framed it. And he mentioned somebody, and your instincts were immediately correct, because you were like, well, what kind of person is he? Just like an anti, you know, anti-liberal party, like anti-establishment left-wing kind of person? Or, and then Constantine just like lied, you know. And I was like watching that, I think live. Was it, did that debate happen live?
No, but it was premiered on YouTube. So
okay, so when I was watching, I just immediately looked up the person that he was referencing, and you were correct. He was just like this anti, you know, anti-establishment, sure, populist lefty type person who serves their interests, but he just lied to you. I mean, he was just like, no, he's like a faithful Labor Party voter for this many years or whatever. Uh-huh. And you know, Hassan similarly. Well, I mean, that guy is just like, bro. I mean, like, the last couple of years, I've really begun to understand the depths of his dishonesty, and yeah. I'm at a point now where I'm kind of convinced that he's like a psychopath, like an actual psychopath.
Yeah, maybe.
Like, I'm
yeah.
not even kidding. Like,
but think about yeah. the reason why it works, though, is because of the algorithms that people consume and the content, the way that they consume content, that they're only being shown that makes them feel good about things. They're only being shown things that make them feel good. They don't ever have to actually confront the lies. Like, in a traditional environment, like, I can't tell you there is no Cuban Missile Crisis, and then the next radio program that comes on or the next TV news segment that comes on is showing you, you know, like, satellite images of, you know, boats or stuff being set up in Cuba, right? Like, I could never get away with that lie. Whereas today, whatever I say, when you turn off...
Deepfake that shit.
Well, not even. I don't have to deepfake it, because when you turn off my program on Joe Rogan, the next program you're going to watch is going to be Tim Pool, and then the next media segment you watch on Fox News is going to have Lutnick or Besant lying about the same thing. And then when you go on your social media feed, you're just going to see 50 million clips. Like have you ever watched, bro, you want to get radicalized? You ever watch Asmongold doing news yes. on his stream? He's just scrolling his Twitter feed, and it's like, holy shit. I mean, it's like, I watched him do this once, it's like, I don't even feel bad for Asmongold anymore. Like, I understand exactly where his brain comes from. It is molded. He's the machine god in the Matrix. It's like, Jesus.
Do you think he is like kind of high on his own supply, or do you think he's just chasing clicks? Do you think it's just about the money?
I mean, it's, well, the nice thing is that both of those things always end up aligning themselves 100%, right? So you have a sure, social yeah. media algorithm that's feeding you exactly, because think about it, you're making money, but why? Because you're being fed a certain social media algorithm. What's that social media algorithm doing? It's also making money, right? So all of you guys are, what is the incentive to buck the trend on literally any of this? Like, there's so much disincentive for doing anything like that, Jesus. And then it's all reinforced from the very top, from Donald Trump himself.
Yeah. I remember one of the biggest concerns I had during the first Trump term was, and this might sound cringe and, you know, silly, but I was really worried about, like, the influence that he was going to have on young men. Like, I remember thinking about that on the night that he won the election. I remember thinking, like, oh my God, like, there's going to be, there are millions of, like, you know, 10 to 14 year old boys that, you know, this is going to be their first introduction into, like, the being familiar with the president. Uh-huh. And so their idea of what the president is going to be this, like, bloviating, dishonest, fragile narcissist. And yeah. I feel like those fears were 100% confirmed. I do think that Donald Trump, just through his example, has set back young men in this country by, like, you know, we might have lost, like, an entire generation, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, or even young people's impressions in general of what it means to be a man or what it means to be a president. Like, I catch myself sometimes when I bring up Obama and I'm on some of these college campuses and I'm literally arguing with, like, 18-year-olds or 19-year-olds. And I'm just, like, thinking, I'm like, okay, when Obama was elected, like, there's a chance that the person I'm talking to hasn't even been born yet. And that's, like, just such a weird thing, because Obama was elected when I was an adult, right? Like, he ran against Ron yeah. Paul. I remember this, right? And it's like for these people, their whole political lives have been Donald Trump, because Donald Trump yeah. came in 2016. And then he was, even when he wasn't in office in 2020, you know, it was all Donald Trump all the time. And then 2024, and now we've got Donald Trump again. So if you are 20 years old now and you were born in 2006, that feels insane to say, you were born in 2006, Donald Trump is elected president when you're like 10 years old, right? So, like, yeah. your whole life has been this. And yeah, so I sometimes tell people, I'm like, you know, it's not normally like this. It's not supposed to be like this, that we can't take anything the president of the United States says seriously, because he's just obviously lying about everything. Like, it's obvious. Like, when he says, like what this would be one of the most groundbreaking news stories ever, that Iran has somehow got a hold of an American Tomahawk missile and shot it at their own population. But it's like, oh, no. The U.S. president said that. So it's probably just not true at all. That's just a very bizarre thing to say.
And I do think he kind of opened the floodgates a little bit because, you know, he just dared to, I mean, he showed, I think, what is possible if you just have literally no scruples and you don't even pretend to have scruples. Like if you just don't give a f- about being honest at all, and if you just commit to that 100%, anything less than 100%, I think will be perceived as inauthentic. But
yes,
if you just fully commit to it, he showed a lot of people that you can just lie your ass off and build an intense following, an intense kind of fandom. And so that inspired, I think, a lot of people across the ideological spectrum, frankly. I mean, I think he showed everybody that you can just, you can make a lot of money and build a lot of influence and power just by just committing to just not giving a single flying fuck about being honest.
Committing and, to the bit. People do a lot of the same analysis now of, not Corbyn, the Brexit guy, the reform guy now.
Fuck.
Oh my God, British. Farage. There's a lot of like analysis of like how Farage works too, because that guy just skirts from like one weird corrupt thing to another, to one weird friend guy who gets arrested to another, to one weird scam thing to another, and like nothing sticks to him. But it's because he's like also completely and fully hopped on the Trump mentality of like you just keep on rolling, you don't apologize for anything, you just
literally never apologize.
Over and over and over again. He drove, probably he was one of the largest figures involved, I would say probably, in driving that whole the whole Southport riot thing. Do you remember that in England?
No.
There was a second generation immigrant child who I think stabbed somebody, or three girls I think, at a school, and he basically just like hops on the at that night he's spreading information about how like this was a small boat arriving, illegal jihadist immigrant who's committing jihad and all this. Like none of this is true. He was like a second generation, I think, from like Christian from Rwanda or something. It's just not even remotely true. But there's just like zero accountability for any of that. Nothing mattered. And there were huge riots and everything. I think they burned down a mosque. It was like crazy shit. Not good. A very big moment in like recent modern British politics. And there was no accountability. No one cares. It's just crazy. It's insane.
Right. Yeah.
Meanwhile,
or like Hassan.
You have
or
to like argue. Hassan. Yeah, sure. Like Hassan. Yeah. But then meanwhile, whenever you go to argue with any of these people, it's like, why don't you trust the FDA and the CDC? And it's like, well, I think one time Fauci might have lied about masks. Like, what the f-? And they're like, well, you have to understand, trust is really easy to lose. And I was like, really? Why the f*** don't any of your side ever lose trust? Bullshit. Like, I don't believe it. Yeah. But yeah, sorry. Yeah. You know.
I don't know. I think this conversation gets at what you were talking about before on a more systemic level, where we need to figure out a way somehow, either culturally or politically or both, to disincentivize lying again. Like that. I think that is kind of at the core of like probably one of the biggest problems in the country right now. It's just like there's just no meaningful consequences for lying. In fact, there's like a lot of incentives to just lie. And I think Donald Trump opened that Pandora's box wide the f- open. I got to go feed my pets and stuff. But you check out the, did you see that there's a Netflix documentary on the Manosphere? Did you see this?
With Louis Theroux. I heard about that, but I haven't seen the Melania documentary yet. So, you know, I don't know which one I'll prioritize, but did you watch it already? Louis Theroux thing?
You should watch it. It's crazy. Yeah. Sneeko's in it. So I don't know. It's very, very, very good. Yeah. But it's dark. It's really dystopian. Like I don't want to tell you anything, but it made me pretty black-pilled when I was watching it. So,
okay. Also one quick policy thing. I'm curious how you feel about that. Somebody suggested it as a joke, but I think it's actually kind of interesting. If a politician is making a public appearance, so if they're on a podcast or if they're on the news or whatever, anytime they are there, like as a politician, so like if you were to bring AOC because you wanted to talk to her about cats, it wouldn't count. But anytime they're there as a politician, they should have to be under oath.
Like when they swear that would fix a lot of. I think that would fix a lot of problems. I think that would fix a lot of problems. Yeah, I like the creativity. I'll say that. I like the creativity.
Okay. All right. Well, I love you. Be careful. Stay safe.
Did you enjoy that conversation with Lakshya? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's always good when there's people who have like more real life attachment, because in our little online world, we can get like super detached sometimes. So it's good to have people that are grounded in real polling data and stuff that can kind of check you if you're getting too far into the boonies.
Yeah, check him out on Twitter. It's like LXEEagle17 or something like that. But he's a good follow. He does polling for a group called The Argument. He just came out with you should look at that polling, by the way. It's really interesting. He just did a comprehensive poll on how trans issues have affected the Democratic Party in the last like 5 years, and
sure.
just there's a lot of data there, so it's interesting. But yeah, take it easy, man.
Wait, can I ask you one more quick thing? I'm so sorry, because you commented on the... Because I'm having my little fight now with Taylor Lorenz. What did you think that... or what did you think I was trying to get across that you either didn't understand or thought I was incorrect about? Or if this is too long a conversation, we just do this later.
About what now? About just like holistically?
The Taylor Lorenz... Because I think I saw some guy, one of Gisticle's Dick Sucks, made a compilation on Twitter, The Substance, that guy. And I think you were saying something like, oh, I think Destiny's incorrect on this or doesn't understand this thing or whatever. Do you remember what point that was? I felt very strong about all the Taylor Lorenz stuff.
They must have like really... I mean, when I was watching that with my stream, I was very much... Like, I already don't like Taylor Lorenz, but I was very much on your side, as it were. But I think there might have been one particular thing, and I don't think I phrased it in a way that's like, oh, he's definitely wrong. I honestly don't remember.
Oh, like, okay.
But
you might have tortured
the overall, I was glad to see somebody take her to task, because I've never seen someone aggressively confront her. I mean, it would have been nice to get her to, like, I if I were you, I would have wanted to ask her, like, how do you feel about the fact that, you know, a lot of people, most notably Hassan, will weaponize your article to, like, basically slander people? Like, if he wants to discredit people, he will say that, you know, oh, you're probably Khor's paid, or, you know, or imply that you're being paid to do Israeli propaganda. Like, do you have any thoughts on, like, would you want to, like, stress to people that nothing in your reporting suggested that these people were, you know... But I mean, I thought you were pressing her in a lot of really important ways, and you know, that was the first time I just saw somebody go that hard. I don't think she's used to that, but yeah.
Okay. All right. Was just curious. Okay. Well, thanks a lot for the chat. Your cats are very beautiful.
Okay.
Have fun. Bye.
Have a good weekend. All right. Bye bye.